Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I'm Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
This is a bonus episode.
It is a bonus episode. What are we talking about today? There's a lot of news.
There is. And we're going to be revisiting a topic that we've touched on a couple of times. We talked back in episode 8, I believe it was, about the way that the COVID crisis and everything that is happening as an impact from that is going to directly affect the game industry. Now, just as an update, I think when last we spoke, there were something like 10 million Americans who had filed for unemployment. That number, as we said on the last episode, has gone up to 22 million. So what we're starting to see is huge levels of unemployment.
Which means less access to liquidity.
Mm-hmm. Consumer spending is going to be tight. People are focused right now on paying their rent.
Which they wouldn't have to be if there was universal basic income, but what do I know?
And they're worried about their health insurance.
Yeah, okay, we're not going into that in this episode. I have very strong feelings as a Canadian, so let's talk a little bit about what we're seeing from some of the major players in the industry in terms of analysis.
Sure.
So lead us in.
Sure, absolutely. So just to recap, there are a couple of major things that have happened along the way. One of the most monumental things, and we covered this in a previous episode as well, was that Sony announced that two of its flagship titles that were going to carry the PlayStation 4 through the end of its time in the spotlight. So that's The Last of Us Part 2 and Iron Man VR have been delayed indefinitely. We're seeing that development, at least for now, is being affected as people still are transitioning.
To working under quarantine,
absolutely. So there were a couple things that popped up this week that kind of bring us back to this topic. And this will be a topic that we as an industry are going to be revisiting from time to time until things normalize and whatever.
Or finds a new normal.
Yeah, whatever that new normal looks like, absolutely. So the first one is a Bloomberg article that came out this week, and we'll drop the link in the show notes. And in that article, this was based on sources that are knowledgeable of the subjects. These are anonymous sources, likely within Sony or tied to a publisher that would be privy to some of this information. Because remember, the publishers are key partners in a launch slate or a launch window slate and understanding what's going to happen. And also understanding how many consoles are in the market puts you at a usually... and we'll talk about this, is usually puts you at a ceiling for how many copies of a game you have sold. Now, there is one notable exception to that, and that was with the Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, what was that?
Breath of the Wild sold, I believe, was 103% of the sold Switches. So it sold more copies of the game because people absolutely knew they wanted to play it when they couldn't get their hands on a Switch console.
It's true. It was really interesting when we looked at that attach rate way back in 2017. Mm-hmm. It really was way back, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's three years now.
That's 3 years ago that the Nintendo Switch launched. It was an interesting time because the Switch was such a weird anomaly, especially after the Wii U and the debacle around that whole console launch. So it is important to remember that publishers, especially third-party publishers, are absolutely essential to helping platform holders determine what they're going to be marketing.
Absolutely. And quantity of consoles in the chain, in the supply chain, is important to publishers because publishers need to know the likely maximum, do their calculations, because 100% attach rate, unless it's a pack-in game, is highly unlikely, unless you're Breath of the Wild, which is, again...
But that was because getting a Switch was so challenging. Mm-hmm. It was the Wii situation.
And also that collector's edition with the Switch case was really great.
Yeah, that's very true. We do have two of them.
Yeah. So, and what we have talked about on the show before is that we're likely to see, because of constrained supply, we're likely to see a situation that resembles when the Wii launched and how there was 12 months of supply shortage issues. Mm-hmm. So people lined up. There were signs in GameStop windows. There were signs on Best Buy doors. Like, no, we do not have any Wii's available.
It was the same thing at Toys R Us, yeah, at Walmart, and up in Canada at EB Games.
Absolutely. So with all of that context, the Bloomberg article asserts that because of challenges in Sony's supply lines related to the PlayStation 5 components, mm-hmm, that it is the potential here, it looks like, according to their sources, that 5 to 6 million units will be in the supply chain through the fiscal year ending March 31st, 2021. Now, that gives us part of November. We're likely to see a mid-November launch for both the PlayStation 5 and
that's Xbox normal.
Series X. That's normal. They launched a week apart. In 2013, the Xbox, yep, One and the PlayStation 4. Mm-hmm. And that takes us from November through the end of the fiscal year, which is March 31st. Now, an important comparison point was that in that same period, the PlayStation 4 sold 7.5 million units. So we're already looking at a decreased supply from last generation, and the number of players has only increased.
Exactly.
So the other effect here on the constrained supply and increased cost on components is that it is going to have some kind of translation to the retail price. Now, chances are it will not be a full translation. We've talked about that in the past because Nintendo sells at break even or better. Microsoft and Sony have tolerance for selling their consoles as loss leaders.
Of course, because they have their software that tends to bring in the money for them and to sell more consoles.
Absolutely.
Which I wrote about on Inverse not long ago for God of War.
There you go. So right now, the price point is kind of the big conversation about what we're going to see the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox Series X priced at. Now, Bloomberg has its feelings on this.
So Bloomberg Intelligence's Matthew Canterman is anticipating a price of between $499 to $549 U.S., Now, it's important to keep in mind that these are only U.S. numbers. This doesn't translate to how poorly the currencies are doing around the world. The American currency apparently is impervious right now. I don't understand why or how. But that's likely going to translate to an even bigger cost. We're looking at a PlayStation 3 cost, potentially, in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand.
And that PlayStation 3 cost was... there was sticker shock. $599 for the model that's
$599 American.
$599 US.
It was $700 in Canada.
Yeah, and that was the model that had the backwards compatibility.
Yes.
It was only the larger model, correct?
That's right. The
smaller model?
No, the smaller models did not have any back compat at all.
Got it. And that was the way it was for the rest of the PlayStation 3 lifecycle. So just to give a point of comparison, I did a little research today. The PS4 standard model is still available, $300. Mm-hmm. The PS4 Pro at this point is still $400. I'd anticipate a price drop on that pretty soon, in part because Microsoft just did one on the Xbox One X.
It's true. So the Xbox One S and the X is sitting at $300 right now.
Yeah, right after a price drop.
Right after. It was a significant price drop.
Yeah, it was $100.
It was a $100 price drop. Like, that is a lot.
And I have played most of my console games on a PlayStation 4 this generation. I think, you know, there's well documented, and we've talked about this before, the problems that Microsoft had off the bat at the beginning of the generation. The Xbox One X is a fantastic piece of hardware. I still think that the operating system, and you and I have talked about this a lot offline, man, that
it's the UI.
User interface is not
It's the great. UI and the UX, and more than likely we will see potentially a return to decent
UI. Bring back my blades.
Yeah, that was a good operating system. Yeah. I didn't mind that so much. So yeah, this is all stuff that we have been talking about, especially over the last month or so, is that we're going to continue to see platform holders taking a good hard look at their inventory and saying, "All right, well, pretty sure that we're not going to be able to sell this for much longer."
Yeah.
at the prices that we were selling
it
at before, or at all.
And I think that what we're going to see, and I did some research again today as well, you know, I was looking up current prices. The Xbox One S is still listed at $300, but it's also in very limited availability now.
You can't really find the S anywhere. Like, I own an S. That was the first Xbox One that I purchased. I purchased it to review, what was it,
Halo Wars 2?
Mm-hmm. Ah, the cost of doing business as a journalist.
Yeah. But you can still get the Xbox SAD, the Xbox S, Xbox One S, all digital edition. And that's $249 right now. So that's the one without a physical media drive. But again, if you're buying it and you're buying Game Pass.
Game Pass is the big one. That was their big Game Pass button, I think, is that it's, hey, look, guys, don't worry about having physical media. We got Game Pass.
Right. So I think the big thing at play here is, like, we're looking at prices of this generation starting to come down. I think that we're going to still see that transition. Again, Microsoft has done this far better than Sony has. They've built a family around the Xbox consoles. Yes, there was also the mid-gen iteration with the PS4 Pro. Mm-hmm. But Microsoft had the Xbox One, the Xbox One S, the Xbox One X, the Xbox One S All Digital Edition, and now the Xbox Series X, where they've already kind of leaned into this ecosystem / family approach for their hardware.
That's right.
You know, I think we're going to start seeing, and this is what we expect, man, we talked about this months and months ago, that we're going to start seeing models kind of fall off. Yeah. Right? And
I think we talked about this a full year ago, you and I, potentially on the other edition of this podcast, its former incarnation.
So this is stuff that we've been talking about for a while. But one of the things that we want to do on this show is we also want to get context. So what we did today was we reached out to our friend Matt Piscatella, who is video game analyst at the NPD, just to get his thoughts on the factors that are at play.
So what Matt ended up coming back and saying to us is just kind of confirming everything that we've been talking about. It's all the normal stuff that's been affecting the marketplace and affecting price changes.
Even before this. There's exactly. A number of normal factors.
Yeah. So a number of stuff that happens at the end of console life cycles, you know, so the pricing, the changes in engagement trends, interplay between gaming and other forms of entertainment. And then we move into things like the economy and employment and just dealing with that part. It's there, like you have a whole range of factors that you have to look at. And even within those factors, there's an enormous range of error.
Absolutely. And this is the thing that I think people need to understand is that when analysts in general, and this is why we see analysts saying wildly different things, or they're hedging, or their ranges when they do talk about them being so wide as to, in some cases, be unusable or not provide much to the discourse. But tacking on unemployment, unknown recovery timing, Matt says the list is overwhelming. So we take these already challenging factors that contribute to wide margins of error.
Right.
And throw everything that's going in on top of it. It's impossible to say. So
there's no way to predict it. You can't model what's going on right now because we don't have anything to compare it to.
Right. So even if somebody right now is saying, and this kind of takes us full circle to the beginning of the conversation about the Bloomberg article, which I believe that their sources were giving the best information possible, I think it is a mistake to say right now we're at the end of April 2020. We're talking 11 months down the road at the end of the fiscal year. It is impossible for us to know for certain that they're only going to be able to get out 6 or 7 million units. There are a lot of things. There are a lot
of
factors.
Or 5 or 6, like they were saying.
Or 5 or 6, right. Yeah, yeah. 5 or 6 million units. Is that the likely number?
Maybe.
Are there things that could turn around that where we suddenly have an effective treatment and everything goes back to normal and manufacturing spins up better? Sure, absolutely. On the flip side of that, could this get worse? Could, as these factories reopen, could there be a resurgence in COVID cases? Yeah, there really could. And that could put that number down even lower. And that changes the entire picture. It changes the entire conversation. And most importantly, it changes the calculus at Sony and Microsoft about whether to even launch this fall.
And that's been a big part of our internal discussions, away from the podcast, is what the factors would have to be, how drastic the factors would have to be in order for Microsoft and Sony to say, all right, you know what? There's not going to be enough supply out there for us to meet the demand. The demand is going to be enormous. This is not going to be some kind of small console, like mid-range launch. They're moving in wildly different directions as consoles. And with spending with individual consumer and household spending that is going to be as depressed as it is likely going to be throughout the rest of the spring, moving into the summer and into the most important part of the year for many businesses, into the holiday season. At what point are Microsoft and Sony going to look at their numbers and say, it's not worth it?
Right. Absolutely.
It's not worth the marketing spend. It's not worth, you know, trying to like push out as many as we can when we could just sit back and just build up our supply internally first, mm-hmm. and then determine a new launch date.
Right. If the number gets too low, then you're going to create a lot of frustration. You know, the ideal...
It breeds bad will.
It does. And the ideal is that you serve all of... you know, as many of your core consumers as possible at launch, get those early adopters in, get people talking about it, satisfy those first adopters, right?
Your brand evangelist. Like we talked about yesterday with 2K and XCOM. Mm-hmm. If you lean into your brand evangelists and the folks that are already going out and singing your brand's praises as it is, those are the people that you need to be serving first.
Absolutely. And if you can't even serve those people, and you end up running into challenges like online games, especially online and service games on those consoles. Ooh. If there isn't a population for them, you're hurting the publishers. Those games don't get a chance to get off the ground.
And not everyone is Ubisoft.
Right, exactly. So I think one of the things that you're going to hear us come back to in this conversation especially, and why you are going to see us come back to this discussion about what is happening and how it's unfolding, is because it is a moving target. And it's impossible to say what's going to happen by March 2021 right now. And it's certainly impossible to say what's going to happen by holiday 2021. And that kind of transitions us into a really good report out of Ampere Analysis that we have some challenges with, and we'll talk about those as we get there. But for the most part, a really good report. And, you know, we talked back on episode 8. About comparing this and what lessons we could learn from the Great Recession in 2008.
Whew, man. Funny thing when you come out of university into a recession, huh?
Yeah.
Whew. All right. So one of the best things about this particular report, I think, is mm-hmm. that individual comparison. So we're looking at metrics between 2008 and 2019. In 2008, consumer spending on games was at $45 billion. In 2019, it was $135 billion. That's an enormous difference.
So we're talking about tripling.
Tripling spending.
Yeah.
Holy moly. And the big difference, it wasn't even that folks are just going out and just going to their local GameStop or Best Buy or Walmart or whatever and picking up a game. Like, you're not going browsing anymore. Just like we talked about, oh my goodness, probably with Matt Piscatella mm-hmm. in our first week of episodes, we were talking about going to GameStop is no longer just a thing that you do.
Right.
You don't just go out there to go browsing anymore. And it shows in the difference between the percentage of the spend on physical media, which in 2008 was 70%. 70% of people were spending money on physical media.
I would actually love a comparison going back a couple more decades, because we talk about browsing at GameStop. You know, you have educated consumers that go into retail stores and say, oh, I'm just going to take a look and see what games they have available of all of these games that I've heard of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I, 20 years before this, so 30 years ago.
Dating yourself a little bit, yeah.
You know, it was going into Toys R Us and looking at the box art and flipping up the thing and looking at the back of the box. And then taking a slip and going to the front of Toys R Us and getting your game out of the cage. And it was a crapshoot. You either came home with a winner or you came home with a stinker. And if it was a stinker,
you had to love it
anyway.
You had to love it anyway because you weren't renting it. You weren't just going to your local Blockbuster or, in my case, going down to Valley View Video Mart and picking up a video game that would last you for 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we could really afford most of the time growing up. So it is not like that anymore. And on top of that, it's not just about the physical or versus digital. It's about what did life look like in the early years of mobile.
Oh, absolutely.
Of smartphones.
And this is a huge one. In 2000, right currently, I'm actually going to go backwards on this one because the number in 2008 like blows my mind. In 2019, so last year, the number of mobile game apps available was more than 1 million. There are more than 1 million mobile games available in the marketplace.
I'm pretty sure that our children have all of them between the two of them, our littlest children on their iPads. They have at least a million.
Now, interestingly, in 2008, which is when our eldest son was born, It was also the same week. He was born in the same week that I got my very first iPhone. So I got the iPhone 3G. Now, remember, the App Store launched with iPhone 3G. The original yes. iPhone did not have an App Store on it.
No, it did not.
So.
That was the same iPhone I bought, actually. No, I bought the S.
Ah.
I bought the 3S.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. There That's were, really dating us.
There were only 500 mobile game apps available, and a lot of them were premium.
They were, yeah. You had to actually go and, like, put your credit card on the App Store, and if you hadn't already done that because you'd owned an iPod previously and spent a lot of money on
iTunes,
music
yeah.
previously. I'm not saying how much money I've spent on music over the years.
I'm just saying Doodle God was one of my, I think, one of the early games that I played.
That's amazing. Yep. That's good stuff.
Esports is another one that has evolved. It's not that esports didn't exist in 2000.
It absolutely did. I mean, esports has existed for a number of years. Let's go all the way back to StarCraft. Mm-hmm. I mean, StarCraft was like the first really, 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 really big esports movement, essentially. And it's just exploded since then. So I'm going to follow your trend.
Okay.
And let's take, like, so in 2019, esports tournaments clocked in 5,000 tournaments that year. That year. Over a wide compendium of games. I mean, this isn't, we're not just talking about Counter-Strike or talking about League of Legends or Dota or whatever. Like, we're also talking about things like Hearthstone and
Farming Simulator.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Actually, Farming Simulator's E-League looks so awesome. I would totally watch them. And Overwatch League. Mm. I mean, these have become staples of online gaming culture because esports has become so ubiquitous. But if we look back at 2008, it was a teeny tiny little fraction of that at 540. Mm-hmm. 540, Mike.
That's so tenfold.
Yeah.
Tenfold increase in yeah. in the 10 or 11 years. All right.
Here's
another big one. So this is interesting because in 2008, Twitch didn't exist. Justin.tv was launched the year before that.
That's right.
Yeah. And that eventually, you know, then they launched Twitch and then kind of Justin.tv went away because it was people were broadcasting stuff they shouldn't have broadcast because of copyright stuff. And, you know, Twitch was obviously looking to get acquired by a little company who at the, you know, maybe they knew it was going to be Amazon. Maybe they didn't, but it was acquired by Amazon for a couple bills, you know.
Just a couple bills.
But last year, there were 660 billion minutes watched on Twitch. So what we're seeing is that the market, the video game market, the way people consume video games, the way people pay for video games, the types of things people pay for around video games. And this doesn't, of course, doesn't even talk about the accessories market.
Talk about merchandise.
Yeah. The market is not the same. So the lessons, I still stand by a lot of the things that we said about consumer spending in our episode, but I think this gives a lot more color to the challenges of directly comparing 2008 to 2020 based on 2019 data.
Absolutely, because based on this information that we got from Ampere Analysis is 2008 was a small fraction of the market that that gaming has become. Mm-hmm. And we can look at this as a generational thing.
Absolutely.
We can look at this as, you know, in 2008, I was fresh out of university, right? I was in my 20s, in my early 20s. I was, you know, I had more discretionary spending. I was able to do a little bit more, but it wasn't until, what, like 2012 or something like that I really actually had any money mm-hmm. as a millennial. Coming off of a recession that I graduated into. So 10 out of 10 on that one. It was tiny. It was tiny in comparison. And it is a generational thing.
And it was still huge.
It was still
the funny thing is, like, if we look at gaming in 2008, we're talking Xbox 360 and PS3. Gaming was still big, guys.
It was. It wasn't like this niche little thing. We're not looking back all the way at, you know, the Super Nintendo and mm-hmm. the Sega Genesis and stuff like that, where gaming was far more niche. But this paints a much, much more detailed picture than either of us had before.
Right. And, you know, just one other piece of color that I really liked is using EA as an example on the physical versus digital. For full game sales, EA is rapidly approaching parity, where last year they had 51% of their software sold physical, which means 49% of full game software sold digitally.
I know that Ubisoft is also, if not has reached the parity, is quickly approaching parity with digital versus physical, because a lot of their games are, you know, they're games as a service. They are live service games, and people are buying them digitally more often than they're buying them physically.
And of course, the revenue profile we talked about a little bit when we hit on mobile, but there's a lot of free to play. So recurrent spending, in-app monetization, microtransactions, you know, whatever shape those take from game to game, from publisher to publisher, you know, those are a huge part of the revenue spend. Again, if you look at 2K is one with NBA 2K, EA's Ultimate Team stuff for Madden and FIFA is a big one.
Which we've talked about.
Battle passes. So you've got Fortnite,
Call of Duty. Yep. Call of Duty has a battle pass now, which apparently is excellent.
So, again, this comparison from 2008 to 2019 is, you'll hear people say, well, gaming's recession proof. We saw that in 2008. The picture isn't the same. So it would be a mistake to say that gaming as a whole is recession proof. Now, this is why Ampere put out this white paper, because they actually broke it down and said, we need to look at it at subsegment by subsegment to see what's likely to happen. Because some segments are likely to benefit, not many. Some are likely to be hit severely. And, you know, we know what those are, but we'll hit on them, of course. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, it's too early to tell. There's going to be forces acting on them from both directions that could change things. We talked when we had Dave Oshry on the show that game time is up, right?
Engagement is way up.
And I think the best way to, you know, one of the best measures of that is looking at Steam concurrent users.
Absolutely. So Steam concurrents have been at a record. They hit records over the last month.
Hit and broken.
Over and over and over again. More than 24 million players concurrently. We're not talking about over the span of a day. We're talking about 24 million people at the same time. Yeah. We're sitting on Steam playing a game.
And we've talked about the impact of that, right? Sony's throttling their downloads and Steam throttling their downloads. And
Everyone's trying to be responsible about how bandwidth is being used. I mean, there are many games on Steam that are single player, that are multiplayer, that are any mixture of both. So it isn't necessarily about like, oh, all these people are hogging bandwidth.
And online games, for the record, online games when you're playing, even if it's an MMO, you're not spending a lot of bandwidth. The big bandwidth hogs... downloads, certainly you're downloading 50, 60, 70 gigabyte games up to 100.
Streaming.
So Netflix, Hulu, Disney Plus.
We're not even just talking about streaming though. Video streaming. We're talking about like actually going and watching a stream or streaming a game.
Yes.
So we're talking about, you know, the NVIDIA's GeForce Now.
Yes.
Right. So that's a good one. That's probably going to take up a chunk of it. Stadia. We're talking about Shadow. So Blade's Shadow. I don't actually know what that looks like. We've used Shadow for quite some time, but I've never actually looked at what that consumes on a monthly basis.
I would think that anytime you're streaming high quality video, because we've seen this when there's the stats from Netflix and Disney Plus, and we know the bandwidth consumption, and we know Jeff Grubb wrote a really good thing on GameSpeed.
Oh, it was brilliant.
When Stadia first came out about how much 4K bandwidth that thing eats up. So that's where your hogs are going to be. So what we're not seeing right now, and what we're likely to see, again, I'm going to revisit the number, 22 million Americans who have recently filed for unemployment. Discretionary spending is going to be down. We just saw some more of our colleagues in the media who got furloughed, who are seeing pay cuts. We're seeing pay cuts and furloughs across industries right now. That means people are more focused on, can I pay my rent? Can I feed my family? Can I pay for my health insurance premiums? Again, kudos to Vox, though, who, you know, and the Vox Union who fought for...
That was Vox Union.
That was Vox Union fighting
and
for...
And New York Magazine Union.
Yep. So kudos to those unions for protecting those workers. I think that what we're going to see is we're going to see a shift in priorities. And it's not that people aren't going to be purchasing games or playing games. It's that the amount is going to diminish. So we saw that spike. We saw the Doom spike. We saw the Animal Crossing spike. We saw the hardware spike.
Yes.
And we saw that up front. But that's going to taper.
That's absolutely going to taper, because now that people have invested in their technology and they've gotten their setups all the way they want it because they had money...
Mm-hmm.
They may not have much money right now, so they are not going to be spending nearly as much money on the software itself going forward. That does include free-to-play.
Yes. And you know, why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that the mobile you've covered mobile extensively.
Yes.
And there are a lot of different factors that go into mobile monetization.
Mobile monetization is kind of this weird creature where you think it would just be as simple as, okay, go ahead and buy thing and get better thing from free-to-play game. There are so many different things that go into these scientific and algorithmic models to help players either spend more or help them play better or whatever. But we are expecting to see a decreased ad spend, which for free-to-play games is how they make a lot of their money. So if we take a look at the way, say, games for children tend to work, a lot of children's games are free-to-play, unless you're on, like, Apple Arcade or, you know, the Google equivalent. I can't even remember what it's called right now. But a lot of those games, if you want the in-app currency, if you want to keep playing, if you have, you know, if you're doing this, you need to watch an ad. Yeah. You got to watch an ad for another game. That's how that Clang Association of game downloads tend to happen. But that's also bundled in with acquisition costs. And user acquisition costs are always high. They've grown considerably over many, many years. But there are a number of publishers and partners out there and vendors that do tend to make user acquisition. They kind of cut that cost. You know, Tilting Point is a big one, and the way that they tend to work with their developers.
And you have people who have more time on their hands, which means they're going to be more willing to try more mobile games. So it's actually going to drive acquisition costs down a little bit.
It is going to drive them down. But the problem with even user acquisition is not necessarily keeping your players engaged. It's getting your players to spend in free-to-play games.
And that's a tough, tough, tough road to getting somebody to open their wallet.
I think the only way that we are going to see free-to-play games, so games that are coming out from publishers like Zynga, they are going to have to take a look at what's going on in the market. And Zynga especially is very smart about this. They're very smart about how they handle in-app purchases and in-app monetization to make it not gross and terrible. Gems of War is another that's a fantastic game that handles monetization really well. They are going to have to model what consumer spending looks like based on that data, and they're going to have to tweak their in-game economies to match. Mm-hmm. No one has $10 right now. No one has $10 to just toss onto their iTunes account or their, you know, their Apple account or whatever to just play more of this game. They don't have the money to just throw around.
People are going to be a lot more considerate about those impulse spends.
Exactly. And digital impulse spends, because there is no tangible result for it, and people are very tactile. They like things that they can see and continue to interact with, that's not going to be immediately depleted when you're like, yes, I actually do want that pony for my My Little Pony game that I've definitely not sunk many hours into.
I definitely would love to consider the Final Fantasy VII motorcycle for Final Fantasy XIV.
At $30.
Right, and that's the thing. And this is the thing. The value proposition is going to, as you said, going to have to shift, and it's going to have to be responsive to where we are.
Exactly. All of that is data-driven. All of these publishers and all of these platform holders and all of these folks that are doing these in-game economy modeling, they already know this. Like, they're not impervious to this knowledge. They're not just turning a blind eye to their consumers. They're paying attention to how they're constantly monitoring it. So I think that we are going to see within the next couple of months, a lot of them are either going to be tweaking their in-game economies a lot, or they're going to be tweaking them little pieces at a time just to see what's going to work, what's going to help their consumers, as well as, you know, continue, like, and by help consumers, I mean they want consumers to have more content, better content. They don't want to, like, just freeze the game. But they also don't necessarily want to be accepting, like, 5 cents versus a dollar.
Right. Now, when fewer than 2% of users, according to Ampere, are monetized across free-to-play games. So that's 2% of all free-to-play players spend, and a small portion of that 2% are your whales, and those people could be deeply affected. Things have to change.
Well, I mean, and whales are not necessarily as important as they used to be, because that 2% is kind of a nebulous number, right? I mean, it's a million games out there, Mike.
Right.
A million mobile games. We're not even talking about games like Like Apex Legends, which mm-hmm. is a free-to-play game. It's not really a mobile game. I don't even think it's out on...
It's not out.
It's not out anywhere, except for on PC, I believe.
No, it's right? on console.
Oh, it is on console. I forgot. Yeah, we wrote a story about that.
It's on Xbox and PlayStation. It's not on Switch yet.
If I was wearing my hat, I would eat it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Hats anyway, let's... let's talk about game development, though, mm-hmm. because game development really does play a huge part in content for free-to-play games and for premium games as well.
I think this is going to be something where service games recover faster, existing service games recover faster than the average on the market as a whole.
Fallout 76 is a good example because they just released their Wastelanders update.
Yeah, absolutely. And while we know things like Final Fantasy 14, there's going to be a slowdown in the way content rolls out. We talked about this with
Scott good for Wilson. Us though.
Yeah, we're still playing catch up. We're almost at the end of A Realm Reborn. But disruption, according to Ampere, should be short term as people get accustomed to working under quarantine. The one thing they mentioned this in the report, but I think that you can't talk about development disruption without talking about the other side of that coin, which is distribution and marketing. We've touched on this already a little bit, but again, The Last of Us Part 2, a major release from a platform holder. They slam the brakes because it's like, well, we have distribution and marketing issues at play. So,
and other things that we don't necessarily have access sure. to in terms of that knowledge.
Absolutely. So, yes, game development, for the most part, as people get used to working, again, there's still the issues that Scott pointed out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where you've got concerns around giant art files, for instance, that need to come down to somebody's local machine and then get uploaded back to the server, checked back in. All that stuff. And there's also the security issues, which people are still ironing out because you're letting, you know, in development materials leave the premises
yep.
100, 200, 300 times over, depending on the number of employees at the studio. Where Ampere says that, and this goes back to our conversation that was launched by the Bloomberg article, next-gen hardware.
Yeah.
That's where all the question marks are. And I think it's important to remember they are question marks. There is no definitive right now about what's going to happen. We think we know. We know what the platform holders have said they want to do.
We think that we know.
That's fair.
We don't know anything yet. All we can do is take a look at what the numbers are doing currently. And I mean, the big thing is looking back at what the NPD group is going to say about what sales looked like in America
yeah.
across all subsectors in gaming.
Sure. And of course, NPD group is just one of the reporting bodies. They cover one territory. And we're able to look at that and say, okay, here's what we kind of think is going on. You know, we see what's going on in the UK. We see what's going on in Japan. So we get a sense of what's going on. Now, this is where we diverge a little bit from what Ampere says. They're looking all the way towards the end of 2021. So we're talking about like 18 months.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any reasonable way for us to look any further ahead than like maybe 6 months.
Yep,
and even that is...
Right. We don't know. I mean, look, there are some reports that say, hey, we could, if we manage this right, and we practice social distancing, we could see normalcy by the fall. There are other reports that say, look, we could see just a spike because of a lot of asymptomatic carriers, you know,
going back out into the world and not knowing.
Exactly. Then we could have a problem and we actually need to sit tight until there is a vaccine, which could push us into 2021.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think the impact is going to be felt. I think it's impossible to know what manufacturing is going to look like, distribution is going to look like, what unemployment is going to look like. If, you know, the economy spins back up and suddenly there's a huge need for people and a lot of people get back to work. There's no way to say, to look 18 months down the road, I think it's a bit dicey. And as Matt pointed out, to us, there are a number of factors that exist on a normal basis that put the margin of error at a big range. Add these factors on top of it, and we're looking at a wide open field. And you throw a dart and, you know, who knows? Who knows? But one thing they did point out is that if Microsoft brings back its All Access program, which is its, you know, installment-based program.
I love the All Access program. It's so smart. I wish that Sony and Nintendo would both adopt similar programs.
And I think in this case... They may, because if Microsoft sees success, if they bring it back, let's say a year into the Xbox Series X's life cycle, And they use that as a way to help with people's like, yeah, okay, I can't spend $500 right now on a console, but I can eke out $30 a month for 12 months or $40 a month for 12 months. If I can make that work in my budget without accruing interest like I would with a credit card, sure, that's something I might be able to do.
Gaming is for everyone.
Yes.
That is, that continues to be hammered home. And I would love to see Xbox and Microsoft relaunch this program with that in mind, mm-hmm. because it is 100% within their mission.
Yeah. So, and kind of launching that into other hardware, PC and VR, we're likely to see the same thing. Again, people aren't going to have a whole lot of money, to upgrade their rigs.
VR is 100% luxury upon luxury.
Especially, it is a luxury right now. I wish more people could get a Quest. I just from an availability standpoint, it is the best VR device I have used. Now, I haven't used
the Index.
I haven't used the latest Vives, but I'm just telling you from a, we talk about time to game, right? Mm-hmm. The amount of time it takes to get into a game and what you need. Being able to just throw the Quest on your head, set the Guardian, and just go no matter where you are, man, that's really.
And then, like, hit things in virtual space. I'm really into that.
There you go.
So we touched a little bit about the difference between esports in mm-hmm. 2008 versus 2019. Now, in 2019, we had thousands and thousands of esports tournaments. I think that one of the biggest concerns about esports has always been what's going on with this bubble, right?
Yeah.
We've talked about that mm-hmm. between, you know, the conversations that you and I have had. I've written about esports extensively, and I commissioned a bunch of pieces on Game Daily back when I was running the site. Ampere, it says that this is going to be a boon to esports as people start to see some of that programming, but because it's going to take the place of real live sporting
and
events.
And it is. And you've got athletes who are playing their games virtually.
Which is really cool. Yeah, it is super, you know, super cool.
Just don't be a racist.
Don't have an epic gaming moment, you mean?
You know what I mean? Yeah. Don't be a racist. And, you know, if you're a NASCAR driver, especially perhaps, but no matter who you are, let's not be racist. And don't use words that you should never, ever, ever utter.
Ever.
Especially in an entertainment setting.
Ever, 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 ever.
Yes.
Anyway. I think it is really important to also understand that there are some bigger professional leagues like Overwatch League, like the International, and things like that. And I know you and I, esports is not really our thing. We don't have a ton that we can add to this conversation, mm-hmm. but many smart folks online, like if you want to go take a look at what some of the best folks in esports are talking about, you know, Esports Observer is fantastic. So if you're curious about what the esports industry looks like, I would go there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the interesting thing before we kind of wrap all this up is that the acceptance of esports as a form of entertainment, people used to complain when ESPN showed esports.
I was so excited to watch Overwatch League on ESPN. And that was so cool.
And now people are like super excited. Now, is there a difference between being very excited to see Madden on ESPN versus seeing Overwatch? Potentially. But I think that as people get more accustomed, because there is no live sports alternative other than watching historical footage, and that's a thing people are doing. Oh, yeah. People are watching old games.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
So as people get used to... I can't explain it.
I don't understand.
As people get used to...
Sports fans, you need to drop into my mentions and tell me why you're doing this. I need to understand you. Please tell me your secrets.
As people get used to seeing digital games on channels like ESPN, it's going to be normalized in a way that we might not have been able to without this crisis. So there could be a
that's a long-term positive.
That's a long-term positive. There's a normalization effect there that this may have accelerated, perhaps.
Sure, absolutely.
I don't think it would have... I just think it's accelerated by.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the big thing to keep in mind here, though, is that like with, you know, physical sports, we aren't going to be seeing any live events. Like, we're not going to have a Fortnite World Cup, which you and I attended last year and had so much fun.
Yes.
The Fortnite World Cup was astoundingly enjoyable.
Oh, and this happened right before we started recording. San Diego Comic-Con was finally canceled.
Not surprising. Very important. I did see that also Shakespeare in the Park in New York was
canceled. So these are normal things. So we're now creeping into summer. I don't think that GDC summer, their replacement event, is and likely that's to happen.
Too bad because Gamescom, it looks awesome. Gamescom, we already talked about,
and that's in August. I don't know that we're going to get PAX. Oh, someone did point out though that this could be an opportunity for Tokyo Game Show, which has kind of lost its prominence, depending on what happens in September. And then New York Comic Con could be enormous in October.
We will have to see if that even happens, though, because of what's going on currently at the Javits Center.
Sure. Which is, yeah. So if you don't know, just as context, Javits Center has been turned into a temporary hospital or a temporary convalescent center. I don't know exactly.
It's some kind of medical facility.
Yeah, it is a medical facility now.
And it is it's not nearly as big, obviously, as the LACC or even the Washington State Convention Center up in, that's where PAX West is being held and has been held for a number of years. But it's a significant, it's a significant hall. So, yeah, absolutely. Wow.
So, yeah. So let's just wrap this up. So Ampere, kind of in wrapping up, points out a couple of sectors that are really going to be impacted negatively by what's going on. One, retail. We know that GameStop is suffering. This is likely the thing that I figured that GameStop was going to make it to its with no problem, make it to the next console launch, and then you know that would stay it for a little bit. Maybe they would sell off because that seems to be the direction they're heading in. This is severely hurting the company, no doubt. And will likely be the thing that could prevent them from ever reaching that point where there's a buyer that's interested.
There's no amount of prettying up that they can do in the midst of this pandemic.
No, immediately that's a big hit. Over the midterm, it's a big hit. Like, it's going to be very tough for specialty retailers to recover. The other one is the industry conference disruption.
Oh, man.
And we just saw, and this one breaks my heart, and I hope that in the long term, as things start to renormalize, that it gets better, but I'm a huge fan of the Indie Mega Booth.
We are both fans of the Indie Mega Booth. I've spoken with Kelly Wallach. Like, the Indie Mega Booth is one of the most important places to go within PAX. Mm-hmm. The Indie Mega Booth is, where the heck else is it?
GDC.
It's at GDC. It's not at E3 because that's IndieCade. But the Indie Mega Booth is how many indie developers get their start in the industry because they kind of come together and they are able to co-fund and purchase the space together, and they end up using, you know, the same kinds of PR agencies to help everybody. Yeah. And it's a very much so an instance of all boats rise. What happened with the Indie Mega Booth?
They are temporarily, hopefully temporarily.
Gosh, hopefully temporarily.
Ceasing operations. Heartbreaking. Our thoughts are with the folks that have worked so hard on this, with Kelly, with all the developers that have benefited from it, and for the developers who are hoping to benefit from it in the future. We hope that Indie Mega Booth rises like a phoenix, because, man, it is the nexus of energy at PAX.
It's essential. Yeah, it's absolutely utterly essential. The Indie Mega Booth, indies in general, like we talk about our love for indies, and that'll never, ever change. Indies are the lifeblood of the game industry. They are the ones that are pushing the medium, that are doing crazy, beautiful, amazing things with video games. And to see that and to think about that potentially completely going away from events that we usually attend, those are my must-sees. Mm-hmm. I don't go into PAX wondering what AAA games I'm going to see. I already know what AAA games I'm going to see. I already know what the AA publishers are doing, the mid-tier publishers are doing. I have no idea what these indies are doing, and those are the places that I'm most interested in. I have like a big spreadsheet of games just to watch, keep my eye on them.
Our thoughts are with Kelly and the Indie Mega Booth team, hoping that... And the indie community in general, absolutely. So just closing out this Ampere report, a couple of net positives that they see, digital retail, especially as physical specialty retailers are hit hard by this. There's going to be a shift to acceptance of digital, even amongst people who favor physical media. I prefer physical. It's not that I don't buy digital, But man, I love having a library. We have a number of consoles. Again, we have a number of consoles in our house, so it's a lot easier for us to have physical
games. And a flock of children.
And a flock of children, absolutely. console sales, again, we talked about the immediate spike. We talked about the Switch being sold out. You know, in the midterm, that's going to be mixed. There are forces working against that and for that. So we'll see where that goes. And then esports as well. Immediately, there have been some challenges. Like, they call it an immediate positive and a midterm positive. I think it's mixed on both. I think that there is...
there's some good stuff that's happening, like the normalization that we talked about. There's some not so great stuff that's happening because the big tournaments, the places where you can, you know, go and meet with your friends that love this game and that love these players, and, you know, they still have their Discord communities. They've still got Twitter. They've still got Twitch and Mixer and everything like that. But nothing beats going into a stadium with a bunch of passionate folks and soaking in that energy, even if you're not like the biggest fan of either A, esports, or B, the game itself. Mm-hmm. So that I think is going to be that's negative.
Yep.
That's sad.
You know, I think that esports events we talked about, I think that yes, some of them have shifted to online,
which is great,
but that doesn't have the same revenue potential as selling tickets and
merchandise
and like right, impulse purchasing merchandise. VR LBEs, location-based entertainment. I think we're going to see that take
that's going to die.
It's going to die.
It's going to die. And it's too bad because there are so many super cool LBEs out there, mm-hmm. like the Halo LBE.
The Ghostbusters one that I did. There was the Star Wars one at Disneyland.
I think that one will be okay.
Yeah, I think that one will come back. But if the company operating it isn't able to recover, I can't remember which company. It wasn't The Void, was it?
No, maybe.
Okay.
It might be The Void.
Okay.
Anyway, point being that VR LBE is already something that is super niche, but it's so incredibly cool. They push technological boundaries and build such cool experiences that it would be heartbreaking to watch these completely fall apart. But I think that they're going to.
Yep. And I think we've touched on the rest of this. So thanks to Ampere for sending that over. I think it's a really interesting report on what's going on, especially the comparisons to 2008. Mm-hmm. Thanks to Matt Piscatella for providing some additional context about the factors that are at play. And just as a reminder, as we close, my last thought on this before we wrap up the show, Amanda, I don't know if you have any last thoughts, but my last thought on this is there is a lot that we don't know. And we're going to be revisiting this topic, I think, a number of times over the coming months as we get a clearer picture of when things are going to return to something that resembles normal.
Yeah.
So don't assume that when you see a report about something in that the way things are going to look in 2021, that's the way it's going to be. At this point in April 2020,
there is
no way for us to know.
No one knows. Everyone is just putting together their best guesses, and their best guesses are extremely educated, mm-hmm. and they're based on solid models, but you can't model this.
And even reports that are based on sources, remember, sources are only giving the best information that's available right now. Not at all trying to discredit the Bloomberg report. I don't think it said a whole lot that was new. I think some of the numerical stuff in there was great, the 5 to 6 million. But again, that's a moving target. So I'm sure the sources gave their best information, but I think it's important that we don't hinge all of our thinking on where we are right now, because so much is going to change.
Absolutely. I think that the most important thing to keep in mind is support indies.
Yes.
Support all the indies. And we want to support indies most of all. So this is another call for our indie spotlight. We are still lacking in beautiful indies. We want you to be on our show. We Absolutely. Want you to hang out with us and tell us all about your games. And yeah. So yeah, you come and talk with us, indies. So you can get at us on Twitter. It's at Virtual Econcast. You can send us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz. And, you know, we love you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stay strong out there. Stay safe.
Indeed. So thank you for listening to this bonus episode. This is episode 13 of the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast. I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
And I'm at Amanda Farrow. So you can subscribe to our RSS feed if you are brand new to our show. You can find us at virtualeconomy.libsyn, that's libsyn.com/RSS. You can also listen to us for free on Spotify, iTunes. Wait, it's not iTunes.
It's Apple Podcasts.
We talked about iTunes, mm-hmm. and then I got stuck on iTunes. And then my brain's like, hey, it's iTunes still. It's really not iTunes. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Podcast Addict, Stitcher. We're everywhere. You can find us everywhere. The most important thing that you can do for us is subscribe. It tells the algorithm gods that we are, in fact, important and interesting and pretty, and you should pay attention to us.
And if you're listening on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and there's an opportunity to review the show, throw us a number of stars. 5 is a good number if you're into that. That is really helpful too. If you have questions, we love answering listener questions on the air. If it's a legal question, if it's a cool business question where we can get some additional context, we will go out and we will ask our smart sources to help provide that information. Please do DM us at Virtual Econcast or shoot us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz.
And we'll be back soon. In the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.